we have this problem? Why can we not control tuberculosis? And there are three or four very major factors here, and the most important factor probably is the patient factor. In this case, we're looking at poverty. There's a problem with access to services in not all parts of Africa, but certainly in some of the parts of Africa. And we're looking at the tradition, sorry. We're looking at, there's a problem around tradition, around belief, alcohol abuse, and of course there are other factors as well that influence them. But quite importantly, because of the load and the bulk of people that come into these sort of environments, we have to look at the ventilation, we've got to look at sterilization, decontamination of very, very overcrowded clinics where, in fact, there is no continuum between hospital and the primary healthcare facilities, even though one tries to, there's no contact tracing, and therefore there is a major issue that once patients leave the hospital, to try and contact them or get hold of them is really quite a major matter. So looking at the DOTS program, we have now decided, and this is indeed with some friends of mine from the United States, that while it will work in Atlanta and perhaps in Baltimore, we're having a little bit of trouble trying to keep track of patients, particularly the number and the volume that we have in the community. For those of you who have never seen a case of tuberculosis, here's a person who's actually got TB, and since 57% of these would also be co-infected with HIV, you can understand that this is a major problem in our hospitals. I'd like to just point out that it's not just South Africa where tuberculosis, but you can see here in Swaziland, we've got a very large population, and the orange bars show how much HIV exists within the group of patients with tuberculosis. Before we go further, I'd like to just define what we're talking about, because there suddenly has been a great revival of interest in tuberculosis, mainly spurred on by the multi-drug-resistant problem that is now emerging. And from the European perspective, Eastern Europe is a major problem. Multi-drug resistance basically is resistance to rifampicin and isoniazid, which is the two first-line drugs. And I'm sorry for this sort of clinical part of the talk, but it's absolutely essential that one talks about this to be able to understand what happens in the decontamination arena. Extremely drug-resistant issues are about rifampicin, isoniazid, plus the fluoroquinolones like ciprofloxacin, moxifloxacin, and capreomycin, and some of the aminoglycosides as well. So this is actually, what it basically says is that if you don't catch tuberculosis and treat it as soon as possible, if we start getting multi-drug resistance, we run into major problems of keeping people, and I'll just show you some of these data. This is the report from the MMWR, which was in the 2005, and it showed something quite interesting from our perspective, in that multi-drug resistance, which was all those TB cases that were tested, 30% were found to be multi-drug resistant, of which 3% were found to be extremely drug resistant. And by 2004, this had gone up. So that was quite an interesting thing to see, that it's doubled itself despite everything that one has got in place. In Central America, in the Americas, this is the 6, they managed to contain it at 6 for the XDRs. In Europe, this was an interesting increase from 55 with 9 XDRs going on to 14% there. But that was made up from the former Russian states, where 60% of their tuberculosis is drug resistant. And in fact, of those drug resistant ones, 57% are extremely drug resistant. So there are some areas where, in fact, treatment is going to be a major, major problem. I'm happy to report to say that, in fact, there is very little XDR in Africa. We do have drug resistance, as you can see from here, but the XDR is low. And indeed, as we can see in the East as well, there is very little going on there. So something is working. And this is just very quickly a map from the WHO showing countries with XDR, and they seem to be really concentrated around Europe. And I don't want to scare you, but I just want to tell you that, in fact, tuberculosis is not a problem just of the developing countries, but we have to look at it in perspective globally. And indeed, there are cases that have occurred all over the Americas, and we've had, and I will address the one that happened in South Africa shortly. Okay, going on from that, I'd like to then, again, talk to you about what's actually happening in the Western Cape. And at this point, I did have some slides, and this is for the benefit of those that are on the teleclass, which I have moved to a later part, if that's all right. Okay. I'm sure you'll find them quite easily. The Western Cape, for those of you who've been, is Table Mountain, but we've got some quite interesting data here for you, where it says that we've got a population of 9 million. A lot of oscillatory migration, which means people come to work in better jobs and they go back to where they come from and so on. So there's a lot of movement. We are, unfortunately, we have the highest incidence of tuberculosis in the country. Ours is greater than 1,000 per 100,000 population, but we also have the lowest HIV in the country. And that must have something to say for itself. The reason we've got this is a little bit of historical background is because tuberculosis in Africa has always been linked to the mines and the diamond mining areas where people came from other parts of the world to work. And that includes people from Europe, and that included people from surrounding countries. The second part of the equation, which is quite interesting, is that the Western Cape, particularly the Karoo, was in the 1800s, was known as a sanctuary for people with tuberculosis. And therefore, at one point, there were more Europeans in the Western Cape with tuberculosis than there were in Europe. Everybody shipped off and came there. And those that made it through were fine. Those that didn't make it through stayed in the Western Cape, which gave us a slight headache when we had to deal with these issues. And this is the Karoo here, for those of you who've been in that part of the world, and here's some of the old sanatorium buildings in that area. It has now become a residual hotspot for tuberculosis, and that is where I work. So it's quite interesting, really, for us to try and contain these issues. Compared with the rest of the country, as one can see, this is the Western Cape. As one goes north, it becomes less so. The burden of disease is, the burden of disease is quite high. We have a very high default rate. In other words, people don't complete their treatment, and this has been attributed as one of the attributing factors towards multi-drug resistance, which we haven't really seen, because the most recent survey shows only 1%, and that those that were retreated, about 4%. So that is quite the background, if you like, of what's going on. So how does this impact on somewhere like the Western Cape itself? And what I thought we'd do now is to give you an idea of a situation analysis of what's happening in the Western Cape in the healthcare facilities. We've done a lot of work looking at all infection control programs, but for the purposes of this talk, I shall only address those on decontamination and sterilization, because I think the rest of it might be terribly boring for you, really. What we did in 2005 was to look at the 20 hospitals we had and evaluated how sterile services were being performed at the time. And for some of you, this might be quite surprising. Oops, sorry. But more than 55% of hospitals had clinical equipment washed on the wards. Now, I don't want any sterile services manager to get up and walk out. It's really not a personal matter. It's just the way things have evolved, and you'll understand why in a minute. 60% had SSDs on site. 40% had a policy, and we saw 95% had separate stores. The cleaning equipment was done properly in about 33%, which is about a third of them. And there's very little on batch recall. But of most concern to all of us, particularly where bronchoscopy takes place in a country riddled with tuberculosis, was indeed where the endoscopy or and the bronchoscopy areas were being set up. And basically, just set up anywhere, you know, where people work. Protective clothing while cleaning instruments, well, you can see from this slide that there's very little going on. Everybody thought latex was a good idea because it was widely available, and not much else. Masks were used when they thought it was a good idea. Not many people did use masks. Aprons, yes, maybe, but they definitely were very keen on wearing overshoes and head cover. For purposes known only to themselves, really. The respiratory circuit cleaning, we found that of the 110 units where they cleaned the respiratory equipment, which is a ventilator equipment, as you can see here, and this is a typical station where one would find somebody cleaning respiratory equipment on the side ward, 30% of these were done on the ward, and the nurses spent over 54 hours a week, which they could have very easily spent on clinical work, sitting and trying to clean a piece of equipment that they had no idea what to do with at the time. Of the units we visited, most of them had autoclaves. Some of them even looked like that. The sterile services units, there were three units that had more than five autoclaves. But of great interest to us was that 50% of these were not working on the day when we got to see them. Okay. And that, I think, was a little bit of a problem from our point of view. heat labile equipment or heat sensitive processing was happening, yes, mainly with ethylene oxide, but some pasteurization and really glutaraldehyde and whatever else was going around. And it became quite evident that there was no structured policies going towards this. And all this was really important information for us when we go into the next step of trying to set up training programs. This is Tigerberg Hospital, for those of you who have not seen it. It's got 1,269 beds, 46 kilometers of corridor. All the wards are linear. They only cross over in between because it is designed in a particular fashion, which is 30 years old. And at the time when it was built, it was the state of the art. Now it's an absolute pain because you can't get around the hospital at all. And each of the wards are linear, and they're about 500 meters long. So it makes a big problem from an infection control point of view. One of my MPH, my master's students, looked at the situation of infection control in our unit specifically related to tuberculosis, and I just want to share some of this information with you. Dagmar looked, and during the six-month period, we had over 33,000 people admitted. TB was confirmed in 1.2, which is at any one time we would have between 30 to 40 patients with diagnosed or not diagnosed tuberculosis on the wards. I'd like you to compare that with some of the hospitals where you see one case in 8 months and everybody and all hell breaks loose. There's a big difference, okay? Panics and so on. A lot of this is happening in outpatient department. Of those, 83% were inpatients, so that gives you 30%. The HIV status of these patients was about 55, and the multi-drug resistance state of those that were tested was approximately 9. Okay, so we had a lot of things going on in that hospital with the potential exposure and risk. But what I'd like to just point out very clearly is that the risk of transmission within the hospital had a mean time of 22 days, and that was based on the fact that the length of stay was 36 days for the MDR cases, and by the time the samples were taken, they were diagnosed, treatment was started, and they were isolated, we had quite a large time of exposure. The mortality generally was about 3 overall in the hospital, crude mortality rate, and about 3 times higher if one had tuberculosis. We audited to see whether they had enough equipment, and in fact, masks, gloves, and aprons were widely available, and much credit to the nursing staff, they used it when they could. But what we didn't have was N95 masks, as you can see from the column, which is highlighted in yellow, where in the internal medicine wards had, half of them had it, and the ICUs had it. But we really, at the time of this study, we didn't have any negative pressure ventilation. We now have got 17 rooms, but at the time we had nothing. And so this is quite important. But probably the most scary part of this was that there was a point prevalence survey that we did literally before I came. And the cardiothoracic unit had about 9% of cases. The respiratory intensive care unit, where a lot of activity takes place, which causes aerosols and causes a lot of droplets and streaming around the place, was about 47%. Internal medicine, 33%. And in the other ward of internal medicine, about 33%. So the burden of tuberculosis, of the disease as such, in the hospitals are really very, very high. And that makes a big difference on how we deal with matters. This might be of interest to you to look at the fact that tuberculosis occurring among staff, and that whether it does happen. Now, because we've got a high load in the community, it is very difficult to say whether or not these were occupationally acquired. However, as of 2008, all tuberculosis in hospitals has been considered an occupationally acquired disease. Okay. Going into this is quite interesting because in the infectious diseases ward, that was most likely somebody acquired at work. Ventilation plant, one of the engineers acquired tuberculosis, it's possible. The cleaners, we think, but we're not sure of the antenatal ward. We weren't sure of the kitchen staff. There were 4 of them there, or the radiography person. The person in orthopedics, we thought, did acquire it at work, but we were not sure of the other person who acquired it in outpatients. The respiratory intensive care unit, definitely. In fact, this person here was a doctor and was a medical student who also acquired it in the respiratory unit. So it was quite evident that transmission was taking place in the hospital itself. So this is the bronchoscopy area, and we do 80 bronchoscopes, a month, of which there are 12 scopes. But if you do the math, you'll see that there are 6 adult and 4, so there are 2 missing. And 2 scopes belong to the chest physician as a personal thing, which means that they never get cleaned because he doesn't leave them lying around for them to be cleaned. And everything that has to happen happens on site. There's no exhaust system. There's no control of chemicals. And at the moment, we don't have any SOPs, even though they're being written up. And this is the sort of reality that one is looking at. So what happens next? Well, what happens next is that we get people who are very, very well-known experts in their field to come along and have a nice time in Cape Town. And while they're doing that, they sort of point to various parts of the country saying, that's a place I'd like to go. But this is what is being done. This is what our sterile services unit looked previously. And the first thing that we had to do was to look at appropriate structures and management of structures. And this was getting very desperate for us. And so we started looking at these, and I'll tell you vaguely how we tried to do it. We're trying to get there. We're still working on it there. We're trying to establish career paths, and I was very interested to hear from Susan about a couple of months ago saying that, in fact, while sterile services have got a very good structure in the UK, they don't actually have an established career path. And it becomes more and more interesting if you look around the world that people actually get thrown into jobs that they're expected to do. The other problem is that our sterile services falls directly under the theatres. Because it falls directly under the theatres, they control everything. There's a revitalization program after 30 years, and I'm very pleased to say that we will be getting a new SSD very shortly. And, of course, we've started cycles of audit and QA. So, for those of you who actually know me, you'll know that the most important part and the best thing that one can do in this situation is to train. And here we've got people working in ISSD, as it was, and then we've got people who are very eminent, and some of them even work in the Central Sterilizing Club and are going to be the future president, and working out what exactly is going to happen. And these training programs have been structured for what we think would be the most appropriate for our part of the world. I'm only going to concentrate on the one on decontamination sterilization, but there's a lot of overlap with the infection prevention and control programs. So for the infection control programs, we have looked towards training all operators. Ward staff must understand what's going on. And quite uniquely, we are now training managers in sterile services. They hate it, but they have to do it. They fail, but they have to do it. And in fact, the worst pass percentage of our course is for the managers. So you can understand. So I think they're beginning to get the message. We're incorporating decontamination to the postgraduate diploma, which is a 2-year diploma, and we're developing and trying to develop a diploma in sterile services, which we're negotiating at the moment and talking about. So the challenges that we have are quite different to what you might have. Well, first of all, English is not the first language, and therefore teaching very complex concepts become exceedingly difficult for people to understand. Okay, I think that is something that we keep forgetting. So as wonderful as it is to go onto the World Wide Web, a lot of them don't know how to use the computer, they don't know how to go and download information, and they don't know what to do. They don't have computer skills, and these are lacking, and therefore we can't really do a lot of distance learning. And this becomes very, very involved in the local traditional culture of teaching by talking and oral and demonstration. And that is where you have people like this trying to work out what the pressure system means and what an autoclave means and what a pressure gauge means, because they just cannot visualize it otherwise. And since there is no really clearly established career path yet, there are few people interested, but we are doing better as we go. So the training format is this, that we have basic principles rather than the practices. A very common problem has been that we download guidelines from the internet and then we don't know what to do with them because we don't actually have the infrastructure or the knowledge to deal with them. The second aspect is that the practice is based on what we've got locally and we try and improve those standards. A sixth of the time is spent in the lecture theater and then they go on ward rounds and spend the afternoon wandering around the hospital. Completely aghast is what they see, even though they work there. It's for the first time to see what's going on and to have people around who train them is exceptional to take them on war grounds. And then they have to go back and complete logbooks and write projects. And they've got to learn, they've got to apply what they learned when they go back to their place of work. And it's absolutely amazing how much change it makes. They do not get a certificate of attendance. People's walls are covered in certificates of attendance where they sit there looking out the window and staring at things and playing on their mobile phones. They have to have a certificate of competence. And that is only after they've fulfilled all the requirements of the course. And they're allowed to resit the exam once, and they have to have a supervisor appointed. This is a payback system. So when you pass your course, you have to take on a student at your place of work. Otherwise, you don't get your trainer's certificate. And that's quite an important part of it. And looking at the decontamination, we have a fundamental course which is run by SAFMED. That's half a day. All SSD operators attend it, and they have a basic 5-day contact, 4-week at their place of work, where they cover the basic principles. And we basically are priming them to get ready for people like Tina and Peter to come along and talk to them about what is happening at a slightly higher level. This one, the intermediate course, dovetails into the postgraduate diploma. So doctors, nurses, infection control specialists, everybody has to do that part of the course so they can understand what's happening. And then there's an advanced course which we are now working with, which is a 10-week course which we have got recognition for, which we're very, very proud of. And hopefully we will be exchanging students with the UK in 2009 if everything goes well. And the idea is to try and establish a diploma in decontamination and sterile services. So what have we done after we found out in 2005 that we had an unmitigated disaster on our hands? Well, we've actually managed to train 38 and going up to 58 non-infection control practitioners moving up. This includes Namibia and Botswana. The postgraduate diploma has enrolled. We still have got 26 to go this year. The basic course, we've done 70 since the beginning of this year. Intermediate course, there are 25 waiting. And we don't know what's happening on the advanced course yet because they come on that by invitation. They have to have achieved greater than 75% marks in the intermediate course for them to come on the advanced course. Now, this is the part that I find that I need to just talk about. We have great difficulty in trying to implement guidelines, and the problem is that we're completely baffled by what is being said in various parts of the world. We just don't think that those problems are the same as Africa. And they really don't apply, and so we land ourselves in like these vervet monkeys sitting there sort of wondering what we should be doing next. And it's really the principle rather than the practice that we need to concentrate on. And I'd like to use this next set of slides, which I've moved in my presentation, to actually exemplify what I'm trying to say. We had a single XDR-TB outbreak in Tugela Ferry, which happened in 2007, and it really, really, really upset everybody in the country because we had just finished a survey which said we didn't have any problems. Now, all of a sudden, we had this outbreak, and I'd just like to take you through this. There were it's a remote hospital in KwaZulu-Natal, and they were had patients with tuberculosis and HIV. They found, during this outbreak, there were 544 patients with tuberculosis. 39% of them had MDR. 6% of the MDR had XDR. Now, this really scared everybody because they'd never actually been in that position before. And one has to bear in mind that tuberculosis is tuberculosis. Transmission of tuberculosis is irrespective of its resistance pattern. It has got very little to do with transmission. It is just the fact that there was not enough, policies in place to contain it. All 44 of the XDR patients were positive and were HIV infected, and most of them died in 16 days. 55 had no previous anti-TB treatment, which set a lot of people wondering where on earth they got this from. 67% had been admitted to hospital, and 85% on molecular typing had the similar genotype. And what was basically thought was this was nosocomially transmitted. And that really got people going. And all of a sudden, there was a very high profile of infection control. People started wondering what's going on. They started looking at their practices. And it was quite interesting to see what followed after that. This is a group that also worked with Gandhi, who did the study and has published in The Lancet. And they looked at the model. They looked at the modeling system of XDR transmission. I don't know whether you can see in the back of the room or not, but basically what they looked at was the intervention and an XDR averted. Community-based treatment, if it was deferred and the hospitalization didn't occur, it was less than 10%. If they did rapid drug assays, they managed to avert 4% of MDRs, sorry, of XDRs. But coming down here by improved natural ventilation and air filtration, and in this case they suggest UV disinfection, 33%. Protective clothing, they thought only 2%, but a third in the staff and voluntary testing and counseling had practically no effect at all. But from our point of view, from an infection control point of view, it was really important that we looked at what was happening. And they deduced that reducing length of stay, in other words, throwing patients out of the hospital as soon as possible, which I'm all in favor of, plus enforced respirator and mask usage was 28%. Adding natural ventilation went up to about 37, which is 40%. And adding drug susceptibility really didn't make much of a difference, but it went up to 50%. And based on these sort of findings, one had to go forward and look at practical applications of infection prevention and control and so on within ourselves. So, the most common practice is that when there's a panic on, you go to the internet, go to cdc.gov, and you download whatever you can, and you leave a big pile of 450 pages on your desk, and then that's it. So whenever somebody comes to visit, have you got guidelines? You say yes. And you put it back again and off you go. And perhaps the most entertaining thing I saw not so long ago was a patient who had a chest drain in, who had an N95 mask perched on his nose, and he had gone out for a cigarette. And he kept lifting up his mask and having a smoke. So it was all really a little bit not happening, if you know what I mean. So TB, as we know, and I'll just go, in the United States, there's five per 100,000 population. And it is quite clear from my colleagues at the CDC that the guidelines are written for the United States. It's for the domestic market. The fact that it's available on the web makes a big difference, however. The exposure in South Africa is really very, very common. And more importantly, the infectious load is 50 infectious particles is what we're looking at. Okay. There's a very low exposure rate. In fact, everybody is Tyne negative and TSC negative in that part of the world. And when one does become positive, everybody panics. In our part of the world, if somebody goes Tyne negative, we panic, because it usually means that they've gone immunosuppressed or immunodepressed because of HIV-related disease. Or HIV. And there we've got TB with HIV, as you know. They've got a very low burden in the United States. We have natural ventilation, which we think can help. They've got mechanical ventilation in most of the healthcare facilities, and they do use UV to clear the circulating air. We have a major problem with cost. If we think that we can only spend 1/500th of what they spend in other parts of the world on the case of tuberculosis, it puts it into perspective for us when we're doing guidelines. So let's look at some of these in detail. If it's a rapid level, then we're looking at level one, where you have to have plans, you have to have effective treatment, counseling, and you have to have supervision by well-trained staff. Well, in South Africa, we have training. It is inadequate, but we're getting there, we're extending it. The implementing effective workplace is going well. We are managing some of that. We don't screen workers for tuberculosis. As I said, there's no point because there's so many of us around. And the protection, however, for HIV-positive workers is there. So we do actually have guidelines specifically for those. And we feel that we must include the community because a very large part of what we do is related to people coming in and out of the community. The second level is, of course, that they're looking at in the United States. They have a local area, exhaust ventilation in all areas, in all patient areas. They have direct flow. They have dilution factors of 220, cubic feet per minute with HEPA filters and disinfection. If we did that, that would mean that the minute we walked out into the hospital, got out of our cars or transport, we'd have to put on an N95 mask. Okay. It would mean that because we don't have enough engineering support to maintain exhaust ventilation, And this has been known to happen in other parts of the world, where in fact the negative pressure is reverted to positive pressure and cause a massive problem with tuberculosis. So we have to look at that. We find that is too expensive, and I'm not very sure. This is a personal opinion, that UV light is all it's cracked up to be at the moment. So, some very excellent work that's come out of Chile, which has probably been a rescue for all of us, is by Escobar, who has done some tremendous work, where they did studies looking at CO2 released and cleared from mechanically ventilated rooms and naturally ventilated rooms. And to summarize it, basically, he showed very elegantly that the natural ventilation clearance was 28 air changes an hour, as you can see there, and if it was mechanically, then it was 12. In other words, it was a far higher removal at that level. And that, for me, was just wonderful, because I thought that would help us a lot. And then, of course, we had the Wells and Riley model prediction, which said that you could really, they suggest that you can only do 11%. But I think that this is quite conclusive, that we should be using the natural elements available in countries like South Africa. The other thing is, of course, that we have got big areas of wards. This is one of the hospitals I visited. The TB patients, the MDR patients go out, and they sit outside most of the day, big ventilated areas in the rooms, and they have bed curtains. And this does help with the ventilation. However, there's also another issue, and that is all patients, irrespective of whether they're single rooms or not, particularly in countries outside South Africa, will have caregivers with them. And so we have an additional issue where we've got to talk to the caregivers, instructing them in infection prevention and control, and making sure that the windows are open. And then here we suggest that if they're going to be in the room, then they should be taught to use the same precautions as they would for attending patients. But what happens when they go home is another matter, and that is something we have to address, which we're going to be doing some community forums when I get back to talk to them. The third set of guidelines is about the masks. The suggestion is that surgical masks are inadequate for TB protection, must have N95s, must be well fitted, and they must be inspected, and so on and so forth. Well, basically, I mean, from our point of view, if we did, we'd all be wearing masks the whole day long. And the one thing that we do in our course is, as students walk in, we get two of them fitted with a mask, and they sit. And then some of them wear surgical masks, and they sit. And they've got to put their hand up or faint, whichever comes first, because they go blue, when they are uncomfortable. And if they can last 15 minutes with a well-fitted mask, then, they do exceptionally well. Now, I know that in some parts of the world, they've got valved masks, which they're using for such purposes, and that, I'm afraid, we haven't got ourselves. We suggest that because of that, we could use surgical masks for TB, because bearing in mind we're all positive already. So if we catch an extra load, yes, I can imagine that's a problem. We would use N95 masks properly fitted for patients who are in isolation in multi-drug-resistant and extra-drug-resistant and extremely drug-resistant TB. And we would put bed curtains around the patient's bed to make sure that they're closed when the patient's coughing and leave it closed for 10 minutes. And we do have I'll show you an example of a cough room shortly that they use for taking samples from patients that are ambulant. These are usually exhausted. And we are having great problem with our engineering maintenance. This is a demonstration that I did for myself, and actually to prove to Peter Hooper, no, to Peter Hoffman, actually, that we could do certain things. So here is me coughing with a mouthful of sugar, looking at about 3 meters. I don't know whether you can see that very well. And then with the hanky in front, and we managed to drop that to 0.5, about there. And then with a surgical mask, and we managed to get to 0.5. So we actually got the fat droplets to not spread as far by covering our mouth with anything, if you like. At which point, of course, Peter Hoffman said, no, but this is all about aerosol. So he said, right. So what we then did was actually, that's me, coughing with a smoke-producing agent. A hanky, which is at 1 meter, and a mask, which is a point. And what we could show that while all of it was sort of settling around us, and they're around me, it wasn't actually moving any further, if you know what I mean. And if we then looked at that with the ventilation system, so we want to go back and do more work on this, and you know, this is just sort of very experimental at the moment, but I want to go back and do a lot more work. And we have had funding now from a large agency to see whether we can look at alternatives within our system. For the outpatient departments and for areas which are very crowded, we're using basically what's known as the cough etiquette, which is a white hanky. You bring your own hanky, and you sort of cover your mouth if you feel like coughing. This has worked quite well in places like Kenya and Pakistan and so on, and it does seem to work quite effective. For those of you who've never seen a cough room, here is one. There's a hand wash basin. The patient goes in there with their pot. There's an extractor fan, and they go in there and they cough. But the problem is that, of course, not everywhere do they have cough rooms, and sometimes they go into the toilets or wherever they can find an outside area to go to. And this is where the patients might even be nebulized often, and therefore the staff is at risk, and the exhaust protection is not as good as we'd like it to be. So I'd like to summarize by saying that, of course, having taken you through all that, that the decontamination is a major problem for us in developing countries, but we're getting there slowly. We need very simple applications, and therefore I appeal to all of you to think about simple things that we can do to make things better. There are services, the services is improving, it's getting there, and we do have a major problem even today with the transmission of tuberculosis and HIV. And I'd like to just end by saying thank you very much, and cheers, Mike. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Shaheen. That was absolutely fantastic insight into how what we think should apply in developed countries doesn't necessarily apply in the developing world. I think we all enjoy that very much. So thank you again. We'd like to make a presentation of the Kelsey plate, and this is the 2008 Kelsey Electra plate with Shaheen's name on it.
Oh, that's brilliant. Thank you so much.